Next, we'll hear from Jay Gaidmore of the Library of Virginia in Richmond. Jay manages the department responsible for the acquisition, processing, and preservation of the records of individuals, families, businesses, and organizations. And although these collections are largely paper, the WRVA radio collection has increased awareness of other sound recordings in the collection. And one of Jay's objectives has been to just increase staff awareness concerning these recordings. Jay will be presenting a paper titled WRVA Radio, The Voice of Virginia, that was co-authored by James Sam, Ryan Davis, and Angie Cornett of the Cutting Corporation. So please welcome Jay.
Stay tuned today, WRVA.
At home, at work, at play, the best in every way.
At 1140, WRVA.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me here, and really enjoyed the conference, and I've enjoyed Austin, and I hope you enjoy this talk, and I'd like to thank the Cutting Corporation for making the reformatting of these sound recordings possible. At 9 p.m. on November 2nd, 1925, ether came alive with the first sounds of WRVA radio in Richmond, Virginia. Although not the first radio station in Virginia, it was by far the most powerful, with a 1,000-watt transmitter. The inaugural program included a prayer, speeches from state and local politicians and businessmen, and music from local orchestras, chanters and quartets, and an opera singer. Here is a photo of the inaugural broadcast. The collection, in addition to sound recordings, includes other materials, and we have a script of the inaugural broadcast. A recording does not exist, but in 1950, for the 25th anniversary, they reenacted the initial broadcast, and I'll play a clip from that. That's number one.
Twenty-five years ago this evening, from studios located at 21st and Main Street in Richmond, at the main plant of Larrison Brother Company, the Edgeworth Broadcasting Service first went on the air, as the announcer's voice said,
"Radio world, you are listening in now on the opening program of Edgeworth Tobacco Company, radio broadcast station WRVA, Richmond, Virginia. We are broadcasting on a wavelength of 256 meters. Our program will open with
a prayer of debt."
WRVA was owned and operated by Larrison Brother Company, a local tobacco manufacturing firm in Richmond. It initially operated as a community service station without commercial revenue and only broadcast two evenings a week. By 1929, WRVA had increased its power to 5,000 watts, was broadcasting day and night 7 days a week, and had become affiliated with NBC. In 1937, WRVA joined CBS and began operating its 50,000-watt transmitter. This large transmitter ensured that WRVA would be the most powerful station operating between Atlanta and D.C. And in fact, the collection includes applause letters from all around the country thanking WRVA for its program. There was also listeners in Canada. A doctor in Canada wrote WRVA and thanked them for their hillbilly programming and said he was becoming quite an expert on hillbilly music. For over eight decades from its opening broadcast, WRVA was the voice of Virginia, bringing the Commonwealth broadcast of local, state, and national news, music and entertainment, and sports. From the 1930s to the 1990s, WRVA amassed a substantial number of sound recordings. including news broadcasts relating to every president from Roosevelt to George H.W. Bush, famous Americans such as Martin Luther King, Charles Lindbergh, George C. Marshall, and Adlai Stevenson, world figures such as Benito Mussolini, Winston Churchill, Charles de Gaulle, and Nikita Khrushchev, and notable events of the 20th century, including Pearl Harbor, D-Day, VJ Day, the Civil Rights Movement, the Korean War, the assassination of President Kennedy, spaceflight, the Iran hostage crisis, and many elections and political conventions. The collection also includes recordings of popular radio comedies and dramas, including The Road of Life, Life with Luigi, Hilltop House, The Second Mrs. Burton, The Goldbergs, and Young Dr. Malone. WRVA acquired the majority of these recordings through their network affiliations. However, the Virginia-related sound recordings were produced and essentially aired exclusively over WRVA. These sound recordings contain news broadcasts, campaign dedication and political speeches, anniversary christening and dedication events, political conventions, programs of a local and programs of a local and regional interest, such as the Alden Arrow Show. He began working for WRVA in 1946 and worked until 1994. And he was a very popular morning show personality. The Capitol Squirrel, play number four. He editorialized on matters of local concern, and this one he's advocating.
Gentlemen, we have someone in the studio tonight, familiar to all of us. And before telling you his name, I...
Now here with his provocative comment of the day is WRVA Radio's Capitol Squirrel.
Why not have boxing lessons for college students? The manly art of self-defense is still a good thing to know.
That was the WRVA Radio Capitol Squirrel.
Other shows included Calling All Cooks, a program for housewives, a quiz of two cities pitting... Calling is a picture of Calling All Cooks. Quiz of two cities pitting Norfolk and Richmond. And also side views on the news. Musical groups and programs on RVA included the Corn Cob Pipe Club. Remember, number 11. This is a music variety show.
The intermission is on, customers. Oscar found that song, I'm Sitting on Top of the World. Let's get happy now. Don't want any millions, I'm getting my share. I've only got one suit, that's all I can wear. A bundle of money won't make you feel gay.
Other programs included the Old Union Barn Dance, which was probably its most popular musical program. This aired from 1946 to 1957 and featured such performers as the Carter Sisters, Grandpa Jones and Ramona, Crazy Joe Mafis, the Tobacco Tags, Quincy Snodgrass, Toby Stroud, Curly Collins and Benny Kissinger, Mack Wiseman, Chet Atkins, and Earl Scruggs. The show also, here's a picture of the Old Man Barney, the show also included a gospel and evangelical show called The Sunshine Hour. The Silver Star Quartet, which aired on WRVA from 1939 to 1995. And also the Zalute Family, Georgia Wildcats, the Happy Valley Girls, and others. These sound recordings document more than the events of the 20th century. They also demonstrate the inner workings of a radio station. These recordings include raw footage of news documentaries and rough cuts of rehearsals. Listeners can hear the broadcasters, producers, and engineers talking about the setup and program and reacting to distracting background noise. In the spring of 2003, the NHPRC awarded the Library of Virginia a grant to preserve and reformat selected sound recordings from the WRVA radio collection. The Library of Virginia then contracted with the Cutting Corporation to perform the reformatting. Because of the scope of the collection, the fact that many of these sound recordings were duplicated elsewhere, and the cost of reformatting projects, it was necessary to select the sound recordings that were unique. The Library of Virginia organized a committee of historians and native Richmonders to pore over the inventories we created and to select recordings of interest. If the program or recording was produced by WRVA and not by the National Network, it was considered unique. To determine uniqueness, the library staff consulted printed materials found in the WRVA radio collections, such as program scripts, anniversary booklets, program guides, as well as encyclopedias of radio and radio programs in the online catalogs of the National Archives and the Library of Congress. The collection included about 1,600 electrical transcription discs and 250 reel-to-reel tapes. Of that number, we selected 800 discs and 160 reel-to-reels for reformatting, and this equaled about 340 hours of playing time. The WRVA recordings presented some technical challenge in their preservation, as the recordings came to the Cutting Corporation in a wide variety of formats. There were a wide variety of problems, though specific to each medium. These formats included acetate discs of various sizes and reels of various, sometimes mixed, substrate. Discs, the electrical transcriptions, made up most of the collection. The largest portion and the first preserved were the 16-inch acetate transcription discs. These discs played at 33 and a third RPM for an approximate maximum of 16 minutes a side. Additionally, there were several smaller, mostly 10-inch transcription discs. All of these discs ranged in date from the late 1930s into the early 1960s. Unfortunately, a visible assessment also brought the first signs of trouble, as many had some form of debris on their surface, usually in their grooves. The least severe problem was that several discs had wax markings, sometimes extending into the playing area. More problematic was the label glue breakdown, which caused other discs to suffer from a powder residue on their playing surface. There's the broken disc. Well, we had a number of discs from the World War II years that were glass-based, and this is an example of what happened to some of them while they were in storage. Fortunately, the majority of those discs had been duplicated elsewhere. Even more troublesome was the palmitic acid from problems with the acetate layer. And this is a picture of that. As you can see, it clear on my screen, but as you can see, the powder residue and the white powder. And finally, some acetate discs had portions literally falling off the base. Since the disc had several sizes and problems, there was a great deal of preparation involved prior to the transfer. The sound engineers from the Cutting Corporation had to clean many of the discs. To get rid of the powder residue and palmitic acid, they bathed the problem spots off in the entire disc in the Kodak lens cleaner, being careful to keep the label dry. The discs were then rinsed with distilled water and laid out to air dry. For the wax markings, the engineers spot washed with the Kodak lens cleaner, rinsed with a clean white cotton, lint-free cloth, rinsed the disc with distilled water, and then lay them out to dry prior to playback. Next, the sound engineers had to select the appropriate styli. The selection process included three areas of concern: signal to noise ratio, compensating for the debris, and historical accuracy. Because these had to be balanced, a few different styli were used in the transfer. For disc in good condition with little to no debris, a 2.3 truncated elliptical stylus was employed. While close to the historical 2.0 conical stylus type, this selection allowed for a cleaner signal that minimized any physical deterioration present in the acetate layer. For debris farther down the groove, the 2.7 truncated conical stylus was utilized to sit above the added noise, and then a 1.1 truncated elliptical stylus was used for debris closer to the surface to allow for easier horizontal passage. All the styli were Stanton brand. And due to the size of the disc, there's several different turntables had to be used. For the 16-inch discs, a modified Vestex BDT 2500 belt drive turntable was chosen. For the smaller disc, a modified Techniques Quartz SL1200 MK2 direct drive turntable was used, which has a retrofit 78 RPM optional adjustable speed motor, which was necessary as some of the discs played around that speed. The tapes were, the problems with the reels were not as identifiable or predictable by simply looking at them. Before the actual transfer could be done, the sound engineers had to identify correct track and speed configurations for each tape. Although this was easily solved, it was not obvious, as some tapes played at 3 3/4 inches per second, some played at 7.5 IPS, and some at 15 IPS. Some reels had all three speeds. As many of the reels were polyester, sticky shed was present in some reels from the late 1980s and early 1990s, while others from earlier played fine. Tape manufacturer brand appeared to be the dividing line. To correct this, affected tapes were baked at constant monitored temperature in a convection oven overnight and transferred the following morning. Meanwhile, due to their age, the acetate tapes were often brittle, making tape and splice point breakage a constant worry. Fortunately, none of these tapes suffered from vinegar syndrome. As most of the tapes were news broadcast compilations, splice points were extremely common. Although old splice tape glue wearing out and the tape coming undone is always a threat, these tapes were unique. While transferring what was thought to be an acetate tape, the Cutting Corporation engineers discovered that the tape was suffering from sticky shed syndrome. The WRVA had alternated programs recorded on polyester tape with programs recorded on an acetate tape, and often simply holding up a small segment of tape to a light did not illustrate the problem until playback. These tapes had to be disassembled and the offending polyester portions baked overnight. Once baked, the polyester tape was reassembled the following morning and then transferred. And here's a photograph of the acetate polyester hybrid reel. And then once the playback of the original recordings was solved, the equipment, the digitization began. For the disc, the output of the turntable was sent directly to a souvenir EQS MK12 chronologic equalizer. And then from there, it was sent directly to a Tascam CD recorder with Mitsui gold on gold printable CDRs and an Atari MX5050 recording full track on quarter inch quantity 478 tape at 7.5 IPS. The reels, the output of an Atari MX55, was sent to both CD and tape recorder at the same time. As this was a preservation project, a flat EQ curve was selected on the souvenir for the discs. For preservation projects, it is the Cutting Corporation's intent to make a fair-sounding copy of the original recording. Once the CDs came back from the Cutting Corporation, cataloging began. In most cases, each CD was cataloged individually. In some cases, the CD contained different programs, so each program was cataloged. In other cases, multiple CDs contained programs of the same show, so these were cataloged together. The Cutting Corporation labeled each CD with the same label on the disc or reel-to-reel, making it easier to identify for cataloging. The Library of Virginia staff cataloged these sound recordings in OCLC for greater dissemination and access. Each catalog record includes a detailed description of the content, a history of the show, event, or speaker when available, and numerous subject headings. In addition to the individual catalog records, a collection level finding aid was created in an encoded archival description. And this finding aid includes more than an individual listing of each sound recording, but also the other parts of the collection, such as the photographs and program scripts and so forth. This finding aid is available through the Virginia Heritage Database, which is a union database of finding aids from archival repositories throughout Virginia. Here's an example of what how they were labeled. As you can see, it was labeled with the title and also what part. In many cases, it also included the date. In this case, it didn't. And some of the discs didn't include labels, but they actually, you can barely see it, but they would have it etched in there. And this one's a recording from Edmund C. Hill. At first, when I was looking through them, I was disappointed because I couldn't find the labels, but as I looked closer, many of them were etched that way. And that helped a lot with identification on deciding what was to be reformatted and also later on for cataloging. Oh, sorry. The etching on the disc, in many cases, discs weren't labeled, but there was an etching of what the program was. when I initially began looking at the recordings, if there wasn't a paper label like so, fortunately the disc was etched, so I was able to determine whether the program deserved to be reformatted or what it was, and it also helped with cataloging later on. And now I'm going to play some different recordings. There were a lot of political recordings, and there was an interesting documentation of the segregation crisis in Virginia and massive resistance. One of them was Governor J. Lindsey Almond, who was the face of segregation in Virginia, and he really resisted integration to the utmost, and he gave the following speech a day after the United States Supreme Court and the Virginia State Supreme Court ruled the massive resistance laws unconstitutional, and this is his defiant speech, and this is his reaction. It's let me tell you what, I'm sorry. Number 13.
To those whose purpose and design is to blend and amalgamate the white and Negro race and destroy the integrity of both races. To those who disclaim that they are integrationists but are working day and night to integrate the schools, to those who don't care what happens to the children of Virginia, to those false prophets of a literal or token integration, to those in high places and elsewhere who advocate integration for your children and send their own to private or public segregated schools, to those who defend or close their eyes to the livid stench of sadism.
That was his last-ditch effort to preserve segregation in Virginia. A week later, he surrendered and the schools were integrated, much to the chagrin of the other politicians in the state. Since they were owned by Larison Brother Company, Larison Brother used the radio station for advertising for their product, and here's a cigarette commercial, it's number 15.
Have a holiday, a brand new holiday.
Brand new holiday cigarettes, distinctively different, definitely original. An original pack, green, distinguished. Holiday cigarettes. An original flavor, smooth like rare wine. Holiday cigarettes. An original aroma, mildly aromatic.
This is Freeman Gosden of Amos and Andy. He was a Richmonder, and he would frequently come back and be on the WRVA radio. I'm sorry. This one right here is a recording of Freeman Gosden of Amos and Andy, and he was a Richmonder, native Richmonder, and he used to come back and have guest spots on WRVA radio, and this is a one in which he was coming back looking for the TV version of Amos.
Gentlemen, we have someone in the studio tonight, familiar to all of us. And before telling you his name, I'm going to ask him to say a few words to you.
Well, I don't know exactly what to say to him. All I want to say is, how you do, ladies and gentlemen? Sure is nice to be here in Richmond again.
Well, you're exactly right. That's none other than Amos of Amos and Andy, known in real life as Freeman Gosden, who is in Richmond in search of a real kingfish for his television program. More about that a little later. Now, Freeman, in your natural voice, how about answering a few questions for me?
Well, if you want me to, Miss Lucy, I'll slide out of the Kingfield, the Amos stuff here, and get right down to my natural voice now. Anything you want to ask me, C.T., I'll be glad to answer it.
Well, I'd like to say...
Number 19. This is a recording of the Old Dominion Barn Dance.
Thank you, Ray Kennedy. Hello, friends along the network. Everybody feeling real good over to your house? Sincerely hope so. Everybody's feeling good here.
Yes, yeah. Sir. Ready to go.
paying a little tribute to Dixieland here. Mary and Zeb sing When the Roses Bloom in Dixieland.
When the roses bloom in Dixieland, I am coming back to you. When the birds are...
Number 27, I'll introduce it. This is another musical show they had called The Zalute Family. Interestingly, to give you an idea of how the collection's being used, we received a phone call from the husband of one of these little girls who found this recording and wanted to get a copy of it to give to his wife for Christmas, and you'll understand why that's interesting.
27.
Yeah, 27.
How do you do, everybody? How do you do? How do you do, everybody? How are you? We are glad to be here and sing songs of cheer. How do you do, everybody? How do you do? Our names are simple as can be. Naomi, Ruth, and Polly.
Maybe some questions.
Yeah, sure. I've got other recordings. If you're interested, we can play them later on. So, is there any questions?
I didn't catch it. Maybe you said it. Is the station still on the air?
Yes, it is. It's owned by Clear Channel now, and that was one of the reasons why we got the collection that way. Yeah, it's no longer have the reputation that it once had. Interestingly, we got the collection because they moved studios, and Clear Channel was like, throw the stuff out. And some of the people who had worked there for a number of years said, this is too valuable to throw out. We need to have this saved, and connections were made with us. Interestingly, we were also looking for recording equipment, and I talked to a sound engineer that was persona non grata there. He had was sort of forced out, and he said, yeah, I had redone several reel-to-reel models, but Clear Channel said, just throw them out. So I fortunately had to throw them out. So they've retained reproduction rights over the recording, so if you wanted to get a copy, you need to get permission from them. They were afraid that other radio stations were going to use that to attack them. It seemed a little paranoid to me, but it's worked out so far. It's worked out well, and I think they're appreciative of the fact that we have it because they've come back and actually used some of the recordings for other stuff. So
they've actually licensed things for...
We haven't worked that out yet. I think they've received just reproduction rights, so people have to get permission to get copies. I mean, anybody can listen to it, but if somebody wants a copy, we haven't really worked out because nobody's actually used any of these recordings yet for documentaries or other stuff. And
but you could go to, say, that family, that was a husband.
Yeah, there was no problem.
So
for research,
got permission there, but if they wanted to release it commercially,
they'd probably end up being license fees or something like that. So, yes. The recordings are not accessible for listening over the web because of the reproduction rights. We are working on putting them on server storage because right now the access is CDs strictly. We are working on putting them on a server and probably making them accessible in the reading room that way.
Is the catalog accessible?
Yes, it is. It's on the Library of Virginia homepage at, if everybody's interested, www.lib.va.us, and it's through the Archives and Manuscripts catalog. Yes.
What's being done with the discs?
They're being saved. We put them in acid-free folders, and they're being stored in optimum conditions, and they're being saved.
And what is being done with the discs that have not been dubbed?
That's something we need to address, since a lot of them aren't. Many people don't think of the Library of Virginia as a place where some of those recordings would be. I would be interested in talking to other individuals and other institutions who may be interested in perhaps acquiring these discs or working on having them reformatted. Because I know some of the radio dramas and comedies, I'm assuming that they're duplicated elsewhere, but that's not necessarily so. And then I think that we would be interested in working with other institutions on that.
Yes.
How big is your catalog? We're actually a very fortunate that we have a very large processing department for our archives, because we're also the state records. We also collect state archival records and local records. And private papers alone, we have five individuals, and that includes myself, to process collections, catalog, and create EAD guides. State is about six, and then local records through a funding thing set up by the General Assembly has about 12. So we're really fortunate compared to other institutions when it comes to cataloging and processing. Yes. If you search under an author or subject for WRVA, you'll find a listing of our recordings, because the title the title of the catalog record that we use in the catalog record was taken from the label of the disc, what the name of the program was. But if you search WRVA as an author or subject in the archives or manuscripts catalog, you'll see a listing of the recordings.
That does it, Jack.
Okay. One more question.
Do you include images of the label?
No, I did not. No, we did not. And that's an interesting, that's something we may have to address if we decide to do something online, in-house. That may be something we might want to do.
And are the discs that you did not transfer cataloged?
No, not at this point, but there's an inventory. What I'm thinking of doing is adding that to the EAD guide somehow and saying that they're not really available for use, and that if somebody sees a recording they really want, then we may, you know, encourage them to maybe pay for reformatting. That's something we're going to have to address down the road. One more. And that'll just this one last question, that'll be it.
Yep.
Can you elaborate a minute on the criteria that you used to select what was going to be copied and what was not?
We had a pretty good idea of which programs WRVA produced, and it aired exclusively over WRVA. And so we used that criteria. And then we also, if it was related to Virginia, we chose that as well. A lot of the presidential, like if there was a speech of State of the Union address for Eisenhower, we assumed that was saved elsewhere. And also we checked the National Archives catalog, Library of Congress catalog, and for a lot of the radio programs, we checked encyclopedias on radio, and if the show was produced nationally, then we assumed that it's most likely duplicated elsewhere. That wasn't the best selection for us, but that was the best we could do for such with such short notice on.
The earlier you go, the less likely that is.
Yeah.
If they only go back to around 38, 39, that's not very early.
Well, the first recording was like 1933, and then there was a gap, and then it started like 1938.
Well, what form was the 1933 recording?
There was the Corn Cob Pipe Club, and I knew that was unique, and that was an electrical transcription.
That's not the answer. What format? Uncoated aluminum?
It was coated aluminum.
We can
aluminum.
Answer your questions here after this.
We have a very short
break. You can take off, but be back by 2:15, okay? That's why I'm sorry I had to cut this short.
No, that's fine.
And thank you to Andy and Jack.
Thank you very much.